You're listening to the Ayn Rand Institute Live podcast series.
Perspectives on an Intellectual Career with Alex Epstein. This lecture was recorded as part of Ayn Rand Conference Global's How to Put a Dent in the Universe, a conference examining an intellectual's role in society and how it can shape the world.
All right. Hey, everyone. My name is Alex Epstein. I'm founder of the Center for Industrial Progress and author of The Moral Case for Fossil Fuels. So I've been traveling from Big Bear to South Orange County. So I haven't heard everything, but I've heard a lot of them. They've been all really interesting. And my format's going to be a little bit different, though. So I'm going to have a little bit of biography. But the main thing I want to do is sell you on a certain idea. And this is the reason why I'm here. I'm very eager to get this idea across. And so the basic idea is there's lots of opportunity for what I would call commercially viable objectivist intellectual innovations. That's too many words together, but commercially viable objectivist intellectual innovation. And just to give you a sense of what that looks like, I thought I would just describe what my career is like right now. So I'll just take the last month as an example, and I want to highlight that it's a life in which I'm able to do work that I find really interesting and meaningful. But it definitely has a strong commercial component to it. And I want to highlight that because it's something that somewhat makes my work stand out. And it's something I think there's a lot of opportunity for that is unexploited and that I would like to see exploited in the world. So over the last month, I've been working on finishing up a new book. I have a book called Moral Case for Fossil Fuels, which was a New York Times bestseller. And this is tentatively called Fossil Future, Why Global Human Flourishing Requires More Fossil Fuel, Not Less. And so I am finishing that up. And just one thing I want to highlight about that is a commercial project. So it's in the, my publisher's Penguin Random House. This is the, it's in the market of, best-selling books. They're paying me money, like they pay six-figure advances. As Jordan Peters said, maybe they'd pay a seven or eight-figure advance. But in any case, they're paying that because they expect people to buy the book. And 80,000 people or so bought the first book as a New York Times bestseller. And so this is, I just want to highlight, this is something where I'm an objectivist, but I'm creating value in a way that it's perceived as valuable by people who are willing to pay money and or time. Another project I'm working on is I work with federally elected officials, so people in Congress or the Senate, often their staffers, on their messaging. And so this is something where people are pro-energy and they want, and they're pro-freedom and they want good messaging. I've created something called Energy Talking Points on Demand, where a bunch of them come every week and meet with me to discuss, hey, here's how to make the best case on these issues. And I have a lot of dozens of them on a mailing list where every week I send them new messaging on different kinds of issues. So it's a commercial thing in a different kind of way, but this is people in politics using my approach to achieve their goals, but consistent with what I think are the right principles. Another related thing is a lot of my work has been consulting with private companies. So, different kinds of industries, mostly in the energy industry, specifically most of all the fossil fuel industry, and helping them with messaging. So it's another kind of commercial transaction where they are paying me to help them say the most effective things to achieve their goals, ultimately to fight for their freedom. In terms of another thing I do, which is related to all of these and feeds all these, is commenting on the news. So recently we had these terrible blackouts in Texas, but in part, I think because of the orientation I have, I was able to write some of the most influential stuff on this. I had a Twitter thread that was very widely circulated, even more than the official one. Twitter promoted, it was seen by 2.5 million people, I think, and it influenced a lot of the commentary on it. And so it's another thing where that's a commercial kind of thing. It feeds into other things, including the last thing, which is keynote speaking. That's a whole market where people are paying money to hear me talk about a given issue. And the reason why I'm talking about this is because I think that there's often a viewpoint that, okay, if you're an objectivist, particularly intellectually, that's a kind of liability. And we've had some really good comments on how that's an asset. And I want to emphasize how that can really be a commercial asset. But I would definitely say with my success, it's, and including the commercial element of it, it's made possible by objectivism, not hindered by it. I know we had John Allison on, which is great. So John gave a talk in 1999, which I didn't even hear until years later, but it's called something like objectivism, the competitive advantage. And I definitely thought of it that way from very early on in objectivism, that this understanding of the world, how it works, how to think about what's right, how to think in general, like this is a huge advantage that would help me in any career. And certainly I've seen a lot of my friends whom I used to go to different objectivist conferences with succeed like wildly in different commercial enterprises. But I also thought like in the realm of ideas, this could also help. And I think it's definitely true. As long as you couple this unique understanding that objectivism gives you about how to understand the world, how to think, if you couple that with a commercial mindset, and I'll just, I've commented a lot on this. So if you want to know more about that aspect, just do a YouTube search for Alex Epstein and Strive, STRIVE, which is a precursor to these Ayn Rand cons. And I gave some talks, some long talks about that issue in particular. But the high level there is, when I say just the commercial element, it's really thinking in terms of how do I create a value that people really perceive as value? So when you're creating value, part of what makes it worthwhile is that it's meaningful to you. But there's also the element where it is like people really perceive it as valuable for them and not just, hey, I said the truth and you guys should all believe it and that's great, but actually figuring out how do I explain the truth that I think is valuable in a form where people will actually perceive it as valuable. And I'll give some examples in energy. I would describe my work in energy as having two kinds of innovation that I think when I talk about commercially viable objectivist intellectual innovation, that I think that can be applied to any field. So one of them is just to make new innovative identifications in the field of energy and energy policy. So for example, one big thing, which you can see obviously its origins in objectivism, is I've focused at least a decent amount of the energy debate on this question of by what standard are we making decisions about energy? The dominant standard that is unquestioned and often unidentified is the standard of green or minimal human impact or an unimpacted planet. That's when we're talking about what do we do in terms of energy, what do we do in terms of climate, there's this unquestioned standard that everyone is using that, oh, well, we should be aspiring to have as little impact as possible. So you can see, for example, when people are talking about net zero, they're saying our goal is to be net zero. And that just means we're going to have no impact on climate. So the assumption is any impact on climate is morally bad. It must be self-destructive and it must outweigh just about any other consideration. Whereas objectivism gives you a totally different perspective. It says that ultimately, now the standard is all about human life for various reasons I really like and have somewhat popularized the term human flourishing. And one thing I've been able to do in the energy discussion is to really make this issue of standard explicit and ask people, hey, when we're making these decisions, are we making them on a human flourishing basis or are we making them on an unimpacted nature basis? And so when we look at something like our impact on climate, if we're looking at it from a human flourishing perspective, we don't assume that it's bad to impact climate. We look at it very precisely in terms of, okay, what kinds of impacts do we have on climate? How positive are they? How negative are they? And then how do they integrate with all the other definitely beneficial impacts that fossil fuels have? And so that, if you look at that issue of the standard and then the whole issue of integration, which you can think of as looking at the full context, those are both things that I've gotten from objectivism and that has allowed me to do work that is perceived as innovative in energy because people hadn't really done it in terms of energy, not in the level of detail, but it took a long time to do that in a way that I could explain these things where most people would find it valuable. So it wasn't just, oh, at an objectivist conference, people would like it. Oh, that's cool that you're an objectivist and you have these thoughts, but where politicians would like it, CEOs would like it, people in the general public would like it. And they would actually thank me and say, hey, this was so clarifying. I'm like, I can now really think about this issue. And there's example after example where objectivism has helped me clarify this issue in a way that people find valuable. And because they really find it valuable and because it's an issue, these energy issues and climate issues and associated environmental issues, people care a lot about, or they care about it a lot. There are different ways to make money. The other area of innovation that I'm, just as interested in that applies to everything is innovation. You could call it in communication or persuasion. I tend to think of it as innovation in explanation. So thinking about how do I explain the truth? I'll sometimes call it intellectual persuasion. So how do I explain the truth to somebody who expects to disagree with it? And using my experience in energy, where I'm trying to change people's views on fossil fuels of all things, which have such a negative view about them, that's really taught me a ton about intellectual persuasion in general. And this is something where definitely objectivism has been just incredibly valuable. Objectivism gives you this idea of a context of knowledge, which I think is the key to explanation and persuasion. And you can think about what is the person's starting context of knowledge that I'm explaining things to, and then what context of knowledge do I want to bring them to, or I'll sometimes put it as bridge them to. And if you look at my do that YouTube search, Alex Epstein Strive, I talk about context bridging, I think, in one of those. But this is another thing where there's huge appetite for innovation. If you just think of anyone who has true ideas that people disagree with or expect to disagree with, if you can explain things better, that is something they'll pay for. And that is something that people do pay a lot for. So it's something that objectivism makes possible if it's coupled with this commercial mindset where you're really thinking, how do I make this valuable in a way that the person perceives as valuable? So to give you a couple of, I just want to really stress that there is this, in my view, it's a frontier. Now it's a weird kind of frontier because it's not that the world is yet saying, hey, we need all the objectivists we can to help us clarify all these things. But the world is saying we need clarity on all these things and we will pay you if you can help us explain things better. They're definitely saying that in practice. So they're not explicitly demanding objectivist intellectuals. That would be nice. But they have values that objectivist intellectuals with the right approach can uniquely, or at least they can satisfy things in a superior way. And so I'll just give you some examples, but it really is a frontier. So the examples I'm most familiar with are in the industrial field. So I'm known for specifically the issue of fossil fuels within the broader issue of energy. But you just think of other issues even that deal with the same philosophical issues that I deal with. So you look at the issue of the GMOs, so genetic engineering in biotechnology, that whole issue. The issue of plastics, the issue of mining, the issue of manufacturing. Oh, there could be an Alex Epstein in all of these fields, and there would be plenty of room to, you know, to innovate and to succeed in different kinds of ways. And so that's just in the field of what you could call like the industrial field. Another field I've been thinking about just as a concrete in the world of foreign policy that also intersects energy and industry rather more broadly is the threat of China. So I had a really good guest on my podcast Power Hour recently. His name is Maxwell Goldberg, and he definitely has been influenced by objectivism, and I think that helps him a lot. But if you watch that episode, you'll see, oh my gosh, there's so much valuable work to do in this field. And you can imagine somebody who comes from an objectivist framework, they'll be able to make these issues so much clearer than somebody who's just coming from the usual kind of mishmash. And I think Yaron raised the issue of specialization, which I laugh when he does that because he used to always push me to specialize and I resisted it for a long time. And I would just say with the specialization, it just has to be, you really care about that issue. Like, and for me, it just took me a while to find something that I really liked. And once I found energy, I really found it just so fascinating to try to clarify this issue, to try to figure out how to influence things and impact things in this one issue. But if you can find that issue where it's fascinating to you, where you feel like you can do real innovative work, which I think most smart people, they want to do some sort of innovation. So you can do innovative work in the discovery of things or in the explanation of things, or you can do both. There's just so much there. So China is one example there. And then the other thing I would say is, I think in the realm of objectivism proper, if you want to call it philosophy, or it often intersects with self-help, I think there's huge opportunity in the explanation of it. In particular, there's also innovation in the content of philosophy, but in terms of the explanation, like how do you explain to somebody why selfishness is good and why self-sacrifice is bad? Like that's the kind of thing I find really fascinating. I mean, I've spent the last 2.5 years working on a new book on fossil fuels on a very similar theme, in part because I'm obsessed with how do I find a way to explain this clearly to people who expect to disagree with me. So for me, that's something that's endlessly motivating. And I think in the realm of objectivism, there's just so much where, you know, if you want to think about how do I explain this so that it can be clearer and clearer to more people, that is another frontier that if people can do well with this commercial mindset, it is great. And so then the final thing I'll say about this is that indispensable for me, and I'm talking about the value of objectivism, and leveraging it, I mean, indispensable to me was studying it a huge amount. So when I first discovered it when I was 18, I was just obsessed with it. I read everything I could. Then I learned about these lecture courses, which back in the day you had to pay for, and I paid hundreds and hundreds of dollars, particularly for Leonard Peikoff's courses, and went through all of those when I was driving to and from Duke. I lived in Maryland, or I grew up in Maryland, and you know, I just listened to those things all the time. And then even more crucial, I think, was when I was in situations where I could get expert feedback on whether it was my understanding of objectivism, my thinking in general, or my communication abilities. And I was fortunate enough when I was at, you know, I had a bunch of benefits when I was at Duke. We had an objectivist professor named Gary Hall, and he helped me a ton. And then the early OAC helped me a lot. Rob Trzynski was teaching there. He helped me with the first OAC writing class. Then Peter Schwartz was amazing. And then when I came to ARI, I think it was similar to Larry's example. Like I was already a pretty good writer and knew a lot, but I still went through a lot of the OAC, and I really got to know Ankar then, which was just an amazing thing and has really been amazing ever since. Even with my most recent work, I'd say, especially with my most recent work, he's helped me a lot directly. And I'm incredibly fortunate to have that, because that has just immeasurably improved my thinking and explanation, even from where it was 2 years ago. So the fact that you have the opportunity to work with really smart people, including Ankar and the OAC, I think that is a huge opportunity. And if you have any kind of desire for a career that's innovating intellectually, I think it would be foolish not to take advantage of that option. So that is my what I wanted to get across. There's this huge opportunity for commercially viable objectivist intellectual innovation. If there's anything I can do to help you individually, just feel free to email me, alex@alexepstein.com. And then I know we have a breakout, so I'm going to be in one of those for 30 minutes. So happy to chat more then.
Thanks for listening to the Ayn Rand Institute Live podcast. Subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. You can also find us on YouTube. If you like this content, please share or leave us a review. For more information, go to aynrand.org.